This is Constructive Voices. Constructive Voices, the podcast for the construction people, with news, views, and expert interviews.
Hello from rainy Spain today. I'm actually delighted to say we've had some rain here in Spain. And I'm also delighted to say that I have a guest that I feel definitely is a bit of a kindred spirit from our chats previous to the interview. A lovely gentleman called Angus Cunningham, who is one of the directors of Scotscape. And you're probably going to correct me and say this only yourself. Do correct me, please, Angus. Come in with your own introduction about yourself, both personally and professionally.
Yeah, thank you, Jackie. I'm glad. Is it raining on the plane in Spain?
Exactly.
It's actually raining in London today as well, a light drizzle. That reminds me of the borders of Scotland. I have co-directors in Scotscape. Scotscape is a company that's been established since 1986, when I first pitched up in London. And we've gone through a number of changes over the intervening, it is actually getting on for 40 years. And we now call ourselves urban greening specialists, and we install greening systems, sustainable planting in quite challenging locations in cities. And that's what Scotscape does.
That's what you're best known for. But like everybody, Angus, we all have our own stories, don't we? I think it's lovely to bring in the personal story that you told me before the interview of how you actually got to London. And it's very interesting. And I always believe that, you know, things tend to pan out if we follow the energy rather than being too strict about them.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. My ending up in London wasn't planned. After school, I longed to work in the countryside. I wanted to be a gamekeeper and or work in the Forestry Commission, being an outdoorsy sort and brought up in a sustainable Scottish family where nothing went to waste and trips to the supermarket were rare and mainly for essentials, but we did live off the land. And looking back, it was just a wonderful, wonderful life in the fresh air. But unfortunately, I had to get further education, so I headed up to Aberdeen University, where I struggled academically, if I'm honest, and felt a bit embarrassed. I was struggling at uni. I was mixing with those who could do a quick bit of a revision and get through their exams, and I, of course, had to work hard on that and learn things almost parrot fashion. So year two, I headed down to London, having written my father a letter saying, I'm really sorry, but I want to go and do try my luck in London. And dad had been, you know, very impressed that I'd made it up to university. So I felt I was letting him down by bunking out halfway through. In fact, I didn't tell him I had no intention of going back. I wrote to him and saying I want to take a year off in London, and 40 years later, I'm still on my year off. But I've been on some journey from that early start when I pitched up and I got the bus down to London. I pitched up and stayed on the floor of my sister's flat and managed to. Well, I didn't actually know what I was going to do, and all I knew was working outside and gardening. Fortunately, it was in Victoria, and I managed to get a job at the Royal Hospital Chelsea, which is around the corner, where I served a year's apprenticeship. And that was my start. We all hit crossroads, don't we, and looking back. And, you know, that university experience was a crossroads, because I did go a bit off-piste when I was there. Retribution in London. So, yeah, and it was gardening because I didn't know any other skills, and I loved the outdoor work. So that was a start point for me.
I'm fascinated by obviously your background, the sustainable parents in Scotland, and you know that whole journey. One question for you, because it's completely relevant to many other guests as well, and I hope a good bit of the audience. Do you feel different when you're outside? And how would it be for you, Angus, if you were stuck? Obviously, we're recording and you're inside, but, you know, in general, if your job entailed being inside, like many office workers, how would that be for you?
Dreadful. I couldn't do it. And it was my mantra. I did not want to work in a big company or in an office. And I pushed the two together. I think it's changed now since COVID. But yes, but I was brought up in the middle of nowhere, and now it's kind of well spoken about that we're connected to nature, we're hardwired to nature. That's what's driving nature into our cities, because after COVID, when we were let out, we didn't want to go and walk down the high street. We wanted to get in some green space. That proves the point. So yeah, I'm an outdoors person. I always have been, always will be. Unfortunately, we have to do a little bit of screen time, and we do have to work, or we have to be organised. But yeah, I think I'm hitting 60 now. Well, I am 60, and I think the future is once the business is up and running successfully, I'll be off doing my bits outside, because that's where I long to be.
I'm going to give you a compliment now, because I can actually see you, even though this is a podcast, we do have cameras on. I'm saying that for the benefit of the audience. You look younger than 60, and actually a number of people that I've met in the last few months who are generally working with nature look younger than their age. So you can take that as a compliment.
Oh, there you go. Thank you. Thank you, Jackie. I appreciate okay. it.
Anyhow, going back to the actual work, why is it so important to you?
It's important to me. It was important at the beginning of my journey in London, because it was about survival, and I didn't know what else to do. It was important to me because I wanted to stand on my own two feet, and I didn't have any other skills. I didn't have any other tools. It's become, as a business has morphed and changed over the 40 years, we started as a landscape maintenance company, because that's what I knew. We grew into domestic landscaping, commercial landscaping, living walls, green roofs. We've been through the whole gambit. And it's important to me now, I was going to say to leave a legacy, but that's not really it. It's important because it's needed. And I live in a city. My friends that I was in touch with at home still can't believe I went to London and stayed in London. But this is, I live in a city, and if you go into inner cities and you don't see any green and you feel crap, well, then we should be doing something about it. 70% of the population will be living in cities by 2050, and we need to make them more sustainable and healthy places to live, work, and play. Cities where they're important, they drive economies. It's where opportunities are. It's why I came to a city, because there were, I didn't quite know what the opportunities would be, but that's where opportunities happen. It's super important to make our cities healthier and more sustainable and green. We need to bring biodiversity in, because we're going to live here and we are hardwired to nature. We need to get nature to work in cities. And I suppose there's an entrepreneurial bit that's important as well, because the challenge is, in cities, there's few places to plant, but there's lots of in the soil horizontally, but vertically there's loads of space. So that's kind of the entrepreneurial side. Well, how do we get plants to work on the sides of buildings, on top of buildings? Well, the sides are more challenging. Well, we need to put a bit of technology there. We need some thought. And that's fun, because you could whet the entrepreneurial appetite. And if you're solving a meaningful problem with a simple and effective solution, well, then that's what makes entrepreneurs tick. And it's for the greater good. I'm not sure we can say we're going to save the planet by bringing a load of biodiversity into cities, but we're certainly helping the war effort. So that, I think, is a bit of a jumbled answer, but the importance of what I do was different at different stages of my life. But right now it's super important, because we need to, climate change is a big problem, but the lack of biodiversity is a bigger problem. Without biodiversity, we wouldn't have any food. We wouldn't have any fresh air or clean water. And just a last point on this, there's a chap called Jonas Salk, a well-known American immunologist, who said that if all the insects were to disappear, within 50 years, all life on Earth would end. If we were to disappear, within 50 years, the planet would look amazing, but the irony is we wouldn't be here to enjoy it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in terms of insects disappearing, I have had a horse who unfortunately passed away at the end of last year, but had been with us for a long time before. And literally every single year, the test of the insect load was this horse, because God bless him, the flies were all around him in the height of the summer, and each year just got less and less. So, you know, we are living in this very scary and challenging time, aren't we?
Yes, yes. Do you remember when we were young, Jackie? I know you're massively younger than me.
Massively, absolutely.
It was the windscreen effect. When we would drive anywhere, the windscreen wipers would come on because the windscreen would be splattered with insects.
Yeah, and now, that's it.
When you speak to about the windscreen effect, no, people don't know what you're talking about. It's scary. So, there is hope, though. This isn't a doom and gloom interview.
No.
Nature's so resilient. We just need to let it be and let it back in. And I think there's time, because we're aware of it now. And it's the younger, my children and their children, who are going to have the bigger challenge. But they're being educated about it now. Our generation was, we felt threatened by nature, cut back, trim, organize, neat edges, repel it out of our cities. The generation now is like, bring it in, we need it.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, so just a typical day of Scottscape, what would that be, Angus, at the moment, now that you are, you know, the version of Scottscape that you are these days?
Oh my God. Early start. I've always been an early one. So I'm up at 5:30. My brain works best at that time of the day. So I come into work. I try and be organized with what I've got to do. The business has grown quite a bit, so I'm not directly involved, apart from being the sort of figurehead, I suppose, of the business, the front person who's got the passion and the drive and is not frightened to put the head off the parapet on LinkedIn. I have to be organized. So that there are management meetings. We are self-funded, so we need to be making money in order to survive. We don't have a big company that's plowing money into Scottscape to keep us going. So, and that is one of our big challenges, is we need to run a successful business in order to do the good that we're doing. And it's very challenging running a successful business. It's not easy when you've got a lot of staff, you've got a lot of rules, a lot of regulations. I think if I'm asked by others who decide to go this self-employed route as I do, I think carefully, because if I'd known how challenging it would be, I quite possibly would never have started. But there again, that's the same for most journeys. You start off on a journey, you have to deal with what comes the way. But with running a business, you need to first go and find the work. So that's off your back. Then you've got to carry out the work at a profit. And then you've got to collect the money. And if one of those three things don't happen, you've got a problem. And that's that. I describe it as plates on the end of a pole. So all those plates need to be spinning all the time. If one of them falls off, your business is going to be in jeopardy. So it's difficult. And you're dealing with a lot of staff and humans, and human beings aren't predictable. And they have all good days, they have bad days. So it's a challenge. And I think, I think anyone can run a business. But to make money of running a business will only fail if you run out of money, because it's easy to do jobs and manage staff and do this, that. But if you're not making money, you won't have a business. So, and a business will only fail if it doesn't have money. It's difficult. And it's a competitive environment, just to add. Anyway, so going back to what I do, I have to manage all these various aspects and make sure that all are functioning. And if there is there's not so much job satisfaction in that for you, because you tend to go where there's a problem. And where there's a problem, there's some adrenaline. You have to sort things out. I love the front end. I love talking about what we do. I like being innovative. I love being an entrepreneur. I like seeing stuff, our products, out there doing good. That's kind of my yin. My yang is the guts of the business. And I'll tell you what, also running a business, as I got to 60, you don't have so much energy. A successful businessman needs a load of energy all the time, especially when you're getting starting to put those plates on the poles. You can't just sit back and let it happen. You've got to keep pushing. So I hope I've answered the question, Jackie.
Yeah, no, that is perfect. And I guess what I'd like to do now, because you've been really honest and straightforward about the reality, and you know, whatever everything you say is absolutely true, Angus. But I guess what I'd like to do is focus on some of the more beautiful parts of the business, just putting the nitty-gritty to one side for the moment, and let's talk about one or two of your works in the last year or two, or whatever comes to mind, favorite works that you've done. Let's talk about those and focus on something that's very enjoyable.
It's planting. We've been living. I first came across a living wall. We're known for our living walls now. That is my passion. So the garden maintenance, the commercial landscaping, the commercial maintenance, we've dropped. We're no longer doing, and it allows us to focus on bringing our innovative products into cities. So it started with living walls, and we were buying from a nursery called Aldingbourne down near Chichester, a lot of plants. And I went down there. This is when we were heavy into the big landscaping projects. So I thought I could go down and see them down there, because I hadn't met them personally, this nursery. And he had a little patch of living wall up on his building. I thought, oh my God, you can put plants on a building. Because before that, it was a climber. You wanted to put plants on a building. You plant into the ground that went up. I did get that rush of adrenaline. I thought, that's just incredible. And the entrepreneur in me was going, yeah, I can make money out of this. So that was my intro. So that was 2008. Aldingbourne had brought this system in from North America. It's called Elevated Landscape Technologies. And it was a plastic tray that had plants in it, and you applied irrigation to it, the plants would grow. So that evolved. So from 2008 to now, we've moved on, but we're still involved with living walls. We've got a different system that we work with. But the project that really floated my boat was when we were walking around in a London with Grosvenor, and they were really keen to get some green into their patch of London. Commercially, property prices would go up and rental incomes would go up. So there's a commercial angle, obviously, that drives most products. But Grosvenor wanted to be seen, and still want to be seen, as the greenest landlord in London. They own 300 acres of prime real estate in the middle of London, the smarter part of London. I think their vision was, we'd love commuters to be cycling through our patch of green, but to go and earn far too much money off it. So we were quite excited about walking around and seeing where we could put some living walls. A whole day of walking, we couldn't find one wall to put greenery on, because listed building concern, party wall awards problem, getting water to the plants problem, getting water away from the bottom, so many old buildings onto which you couldn't put living walls. So we felt a bit despondent, but it was at that, the light bulb moment came out of that despondency, because we were standing up on a busy street. We thought, this is rubbish. You can't plant anywhere. You can't plant in the pavement, because pavements are for pedestrians. So there's too many services under these pavement stones. You can't plant the roads, because they're for traffic. Or there's a lamppost. What happened if you put planting on a lamppost? And then you thought, because our system we use is called phytotextile, it's a fabric, so it's very flexible. Well, yeah, we could wrap that around the lamppost. And what happened if we put a tank at the bottom and actually wrap that around the lamppost as well? So the water was sitting there, and we could pump it up to the top, and water, and the idea was sown. And from that, we developed our concept called the Living Pillar. It's been designed to go on lampposts, sustainable long-term planting, powered by solar, with tech in it. It's tech that we use on living walls, so it's not brand new tech, but the powered by solar is new. So we can communicate with the lamppost, and we can make sure the plants are receiving the correct amount of water, the AI or clever software that manages the irrigation system, because the city climate is not conducive to good plant health. You need to put water on at the right times and the right amount. So the living pillar concept was born, and I just love it. I love it because it's innovative, it's entrepreneurial, it solves a problem. They're definitely not there to replace trees. I am a tree hugger. I came out about this about 10 years ago. I've climbed so many trees in my life. I love trees. But the challenge is you can't plant trees in cities or certain cities because there's no room in the pavement to plant them. And more than that, councils are very concerned about root damage, et cetera, et cetera. So trees are fantastic, create shade, they can absorb pollution or disperse pollution. But the living pillar is to be put up where you can't plant trees. And in my mind's eye, I've got biodiversity corridor. Every city has been designed around roads and transport. Every road has lampposts. So if you can put long-term planting on lampposts, you can join up green spaces. You can bring some of the countryside in. And when I say biodiversity corridor, I'm not meaning wildebeest charging through the streets. We're talking invertebrates, pollinators, and birds will follow them. And we've shown that can happen. But yeah, so the invertebrates can use the lampposts as feeding stations. And another, service stations. But in my entrepreneurial start in London, I made up hanging baskets in Victoria and hung around some pubs. And it was good money and great fun. And I'm a fan. And a hanging basket is a very innovative way of bringing some green into somewhere where otherwise you can't plant. And they've been around forever. And my parents put them up, bizarrely, in our little village. But when you come to biodiversity, they're not great because plants get changed once or twice a year. So any invertebrates that are establishing a life cycle, they're killed when the plants change. Whereas if you can sustain long-term planting, i.e. on a lamppost or on a building site, doesn't have to be a lamppost, you can encourage invertebrates to hang about there by putting perennial planting as opposed to annual planting on a lamppost. You get a wider range of pollinators, and that's important as well. So and then life cycles can happen. We hang insect and bird boxes on the living pillars. It's a great message to the public. That's what they're about, but also their use. So that's a long story there, but totally passionate about them. We were contacted by the Earthshot Prize, Prince William's competition, who suggested we put ourselves forward for that, which we have done. So we'll wait to hear in 2024. And commercially, we've registered the trademark, and we have an international patent pending.
You have an international what?
Patent pending.
Brilliant.
So we've applied for patents. It takes forever. Patents seem to be very complex, especially post-COVID in this world of technology, because we've patented some of the technology involved in sustaining the healthy plants. So it's exciting because therefore you can see why it's exciting. We can make some money out of it. We can bring biodiversity in. We can solve a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I get to look good, Jackie, after all these years of being a gardener.
Brilliant. Now, Angus, what about biodiversity net gain? Because you're talking obviously about, you know, your opportunities and what you've created. Have you been dipping into that? Because, okay, it's very early days, but we have technological solutions. We have a lot of, like, people are kind of concerned about how it's all going to work out. But, you know, presumably you can help there also.
Yeah, so that big for our market, massive. The biodiversity net gain, but for those who don't know it's now a law that says if a developer is developing a plot of land, they've got to demonstrate they're going to increase the biodiversity of that plot of land by a minimum of 10%. Over 35 years, mind you, so they've got a long time to do it. A minimum of 10%. They won't get planning permission unless they can demonstrate that they are able to increase the biodiversity net gain of that plot of land. Some councils are saying 20%, which is fantastic. But what their challenge is, they're now running around thinking, oh my God, how are we going to do this? If you think about it, if you've got a footprint of land 20 metres by 20 metres, you're going to put a building on 90% of that land. So the bit that's left, you've got to increase the biodiversity by 100% because you've taken out a big rectangle in the middle. So that's a challenge for the developers. They've got three options. One, they put the green into that plot on the building, around the building. They buy biodiversity credits from the council, from the government, which means that they pay quite a lot of money to the government, and the government then spends their money on some biodiversity project, or they get off-site credits where they buy a patch of land somewhere in the countryside and they demonstrate that the biodiversity they couldn't put into their development can actually happen on that plot of land. But I'm finding, so as you can imagine, it's huge for our industry, because we all talked about it, but unless the developers have a sharp stick prodding them along, they'd never do it, because it costs them money, they don't make so much, and their shareholders get annoyed. So it is huge for our industry, and just what was needed, and just in the nick of time. So that's biodiversity net gain. The urban greening factor, so I think biodiversity net gain is more for outside of towns, because if a developer is developing in a town, there's very little biodiversity there to start off with, so they can't, they've got an easy job, you know, increasing it by 10%, they might put one little bit of planting in. So for towns, we've got the urban greening factor, which is a kind of a subset of the biodiversity net gain, which is measured, it's measurable. So there's a point scoring system and a metric, and it's about habitats and greenery and areas of greenery and types of greenery. For example, if you put artificial lawn in, you get no points. If you put wildflower meadow in, you get, I think, a 0.7 of a point. One is a maximum. You put trees or water in, not a water feature with chlorine, but a pond, you get maximum points. So there's a scoring system. So that is one we're finding more and more in our world of biodiversity and city depth, the concentrate on the urban greening factor. And I suppose the holy grail is, if you say to a developer wants to put development together, and you say, if you do this, this, and this, here's your points, you can do your development, and they'll say, yes, go. And that's the holy grail, is turning our innovative living pillars or living walls into points that helps. And I do say, if anyone's looking to have a career advice, become an ecologist or a plants person. I was going to say plantsman, cut that, plants person. Knowing your plants and what they do is massive. So in the early days of Scotscape, when we had the maintenance round and it was tools on the tube, as I explained earlier, we got into commercial landscaping. For a developer to get permission to put landscaping up, the landscape architect would draw a bit of grass, a tree, a shrub, and that would be enough. Now we're being asked for, how much nitrogen dioxide do those plants trap? How much biodiversity do they bring in? How much do they cost to maintain? How much carbon is sequestered? How many particulates are being absorbed? What does it look like at this time of year? What's it look like? It's huge, absolutely, and so right and so necessary. So the biodiversity net gain been a shot of adrenaline in the arm of greening into cities. So fantastic for our industry. But I do add, we've got environmental social governance, which is also big, with especially the E, the environmental. S, the social, local employment. So if you're putting fancy green in and needs watering, then you're getting some employment going there. B Corp status is another one, another standard about sustainability. But you know what I think, Jackie? The biggest driver is the consumer. And so the developer puts a building up and says, oh, I can't put any green here, I have to do it off-site. I don't think people will move in because they want to be around green. So the bigger driver is you and me, who is deciding what they want to get involved with or buy. And if there's more green there, you're more likely to buy it. I think the developer knows that.
This is something that I've discussed with other guests. Actually, historically, you know, having land is associated with wealth and well-being. And now with the meta crisis that we're all living through at the moment, you know, people who weren't maybe that knowledgeable about this, they're really realizing it. So it's highly desirable. So you're absolutely correct. And right now BNG only applies in England since the 12th of February, 2024.
Yeah.
Of course, as I'm aware from guests and just seeing stuff online and so on, there's a lot of the world are watching England to see how this is going to go. And what you said about the urban greening, obviously massively, massively important as well. So it's kind of like a watch this space, really, isn't it?
It is. Singapore's ahead of the curve with green. I must go out and have a look. But I was told not so long ago by West, we do a fair bit of work with Westminster, and we're trying some of our living pillars in Westminster, that all the big cities look at each other and see what they're up to. And I think it's New York, Paris, Milan, Tokyo, and London. I don't know where they came, the big five. And they all look at each other and say, what are you doing to make a difference? What are you doing? So there is a little bit of ego in there with regards to, no, we've got the best innovative way to bring green in. And that's a good, healthy competition, especially we're in London, centre of the world. I shouldn't say that being a Scotsman. I do. I've been here long enough. On the last question, biodiversity net gain, urban greening factor, B Corp status, environmental and social governance. Just quickly on the ESG, I have a good, the big players, the corporates, this is sort of touching on greenwashing, want to be seen to be doing green, and the company shall remain nameless, but I know someone quite high up in a manufacturing company, they manufacture shirts, and he said to me, he knows what I do, he said, oh, we're really green, we plant a load of trees. I thought, that's great, I love trees, where what happens, tell me about it. And he said, well, we pay a company over there to plant trees in South America. I said, why did you do that? He said, well, because it's much cheaper and we get more bang for our bucks. And why aren't you planting them in this country? Bonkers. They are an English company. They've changed a bit and then got involved some other stuff. So, and they shall remain nameless. But I thought, this is the environmental social governance is super important. Financial markets are more likely to take note of and invest in someone with a high ESG rating. So I think that is the super big driver for the big players who want to be green. I mean, I said to this guy, why don't you plant trees in schools? Because Scotscape are involved in microforests using the Miyawaki method. It's on our website, where you plant trees very densely with some clever ground preparation. We took one. It's actually lovely because it's low tech. Once you plant it, you're off and running. But then why don't you plant some microforest in schools? Because the microforest we planted in Islington, we got a school involved to plant the trees and put worms in. The inner city children loved it. Because if you, Mr. Corporate, say, all right, I'm spending all this money in South America, we're not getting the benefit of it. And basically, as far as I'm concerned, you're ticking a box. If you plant it in a school, we can educate the school kids. You get a forest in an inner city, because these forests can maybe be a tennis court size or a little bit smaller. You get all the carbon. No, trees are big, as we know. We don't want to plant a tree. You've got everyone wins. The kids get educated. You get seen to be giving back. You get seen to be doing good. We put more trees in. And then using a bit of software called iTrees, which the Mayor of London uses, you can provide all this data about how much good the trees are doing, from trapping carbon, absorbing particulates, trapping nitrogen dioxide, trapping carbon monoxide, the whole gambit. And it's bomb. So, yeah, I don't know, it's frustrating. The big, I'm not going to shift the mindset of a big corporate, but it doesn't make sense to me to be doing all that good. Obviously, they can come and do it in Spain, Jackie. I know you have a vested interest in parts of Spain, so but no, seriously, it's just silly. Spend your money in this country.
Absolutely. Now, one question, Angus, that comes into my mind is, why do you only work in cities?
Yeah, a good question. I think the short answer is because I live here and I'm selfish. I live here. I live in one. I live in London. I am a country lad. My formative years until I was 20, when I headed to London, were spent in the southern uplands, the range of hills running across Scotland. And I always saw myself as an estate manager. In those days, cutting down trees, I turned into planting them. Cities are where, I mentioned this at the beginning, are where most of the population are going and where I live, where opportunities are, they drive economy. So they're really, really important. And the population is growing and that growth is going to cities. So they're not the best places to live from the air pollution point of view and the greenery point of view. So we work in cities because that's where the opportunities are. That's where we're going to get best bang for our bucks and make a difference quickly. And it ticks my innovative and entrepreneurial boxes. And I think in the countryside, there's another big challenge. There's only one of us. And if we spread ourselves too thin, we're not going to go anywhere. But, the countryside's another challenge. So we're based in a city. That's where we operate and where we can do the most good quickly.
We talked already about your living pillars, but you do have other innovations, Angus. Do you want to talk about those?
Yes. I think the microforest that I've just mentioned is a big one for me because it uses low tech and it means planting trees, which I'm passionate about. And bear in mind, our innovative stuff, although it resonates with me in the business, and it does a lot of good. We're having to be innovative because there's nowhere to plant trees. But where you've got a corner of a park or a patch of green, then you can plant. I mean, the word forest is a bit romantic, isn't it? But they're called microforests, but really they're copses or spinnies of trees, often no bigger than a tennis court size. And you get all the ecology growing in a tennis court size. We use the Miyawaki method. Akira Miyawaki, a bit like Patrick Blanc was for Living Walls, an entrepreneur who pushed the boundaries. Akira Miyawaki pushed the boundaries. So his sort of mission or raison d'etre of being on this planet was to get trees to grow well in very poor soil. And he developed a methodology of planting trees very densely, close together. He would excavate the area down to maybe 500 mil, 50 centimetres, 2 foot in old money. Get local rotten foodstuffs that have been chucked out, lay it in the bottom, push all the soil back, plant very small trees very closely together, mulch it with, it was straw in those days, but you can use a bark mulch, and then just let nature take over. And that resonated with me because, and I've done it at home. I've hung some living wall panels on the side of my property with weed treated compost in there and said, nature, just go do your worst with it. And I've got cherry trees growing out of it. I've got ferns. I've got a whole wide range of what we would call weeds. That's a whole nother thing. But it's green. So nature has dropped the green in. So with the microforest, it's the same thing. We kickstart nature. It's kind of town rewilding or city rewilding. And rewilding is a marathon starting with a sprint. So you put a lot of energy in to plant the tree, and then you just let it be. You just let nature take over. So the twist we've done, the sort of entrepreneurial, innovative thing we've done with our microforests, we don't dig up the soil. That's very labour intensive. It releases carbon into the air, and it's costly. So what we've done, and again, you can go on our website and have a look. We've got a case study. We inject high pressure air into the area to break up the subsoil. Then using the same needle, injection needle, it's a method using for decompacting around trees to help root spread. So then using the same needle, we'll pump in biochar, organic nutrients and mycorrhiza, and they will keep the fissures open and provide all the goodness that the forest needs. And then we'll spread approximately 150 mil depth of mineral enriched topsoil over the whole area. So there's no digging whatsoever. And in that top layer of soil, which is very friable and easy to plant into, we plant cell-grown trees. Now, there's a number of reasons for that, but the main one is we have a huge success rate with cell-grown trees because the roots aren't damaged. Secondly, we can...
Let me jump in there, Angus. The name of those trees again?
Cell-grown. So they're grown... It's a method of growing trees. They're grown in tiny pots, like an egg box.
Okay.
So they're from 6 inches to 12 inches tall, and the roots are contained in this little egg. Imagine an egg box with six little trees growing in. You take the tree out, so all the roots are under a little bundle, they're not damaged. You can pop them into the literally popped them there. Given my injury, just pop it in there, pop to the bottom. plant them into the topsoil. And children can do it, because you're not planting into heavy clay or using a big spade and it's hard work. You're planting very small trees into 4 to 6 inches of topsoil. And then, so we plant them really close together, same as the Miyawaki method, to encourage competition. We brought worms in on this particular case study in Islington, and each of the children popped a worm, actually popped again, put a worm in with the tree. Because if we're doing all this goodness and preparation, you need to put some worms in there to get the cycles going, to keep the air going into the subsoil and take the goodness from above down. So that's nature. As I say, it's a sprint followed by a marathon. And then once we've planted the trees, we'll mulch it all. But on that particular project, I went back 6 months later, and some of the trees had grown to over 6 foot tall. But it was more than that. The amount of bright, and we fenced it off using some chestnut fencing, the amount of greenery that sort of cropped up amongst the trees. It was like an oasis of green in a corner of a not the most attractive park. It's a dog walker's park. A year later, the trees are over 2 meters tall. So it's just incredible that all we're saying is that we're getting this bit back to nature. We plant high canopy, mid canopy, and low canopy trees and ground cover. So there's a little bit of thought to the design, but not a lot of thought of where they're positioned. So we literally mix and match them throughout the whole area, plant really closely together. There will be some failures, but there's competition, and that's why the trees are growing so quickly. And that's what happens in nature.
That's fascinating.
That's what I've done on the side of my building. You say, I'll give you a plot, I'll give you a kickstart.
That's fascinating. Now, going back to your website, we will obviously be adding it to the episode page and on the podcast directories and all that type of stuff. But for those listening, just as a reminder, it's Scotscape. And it's .co.uk or what,
yeah,
what have we got exactly?
.co.uk. A quick funny story, because when I started, I was very naive when I came to London, and Scotscape came about. We were, it was myself and another Scotsman called Richie, and we were living above a garage in South London, Clapham. There's another story how we got there. It's like a massive shed above a panel beater's garage. And the landlord said to me, I need to send you an invoice. And I said, what's an invoice? I had no clue, honestly, Jackie. I don't know how I've got to where I've got to sometimes. He said, I've got to send an invoice. What's that? I said. He said, well, it's a bit of paper that says you owe me money. I said, what do I owe you money for? He said, rent. I said, okay. So I get the process. But I need to make the invoice out to someone. Who do I make it out to? And at that time, we didn't have a name, although we were doing our garden maintenance. And he said, well, you're both Scottish landscapers. Why don't we just call you Scotscape?
Oh, brilliant.
You can spend all this money on marketing and this and that, but
that would have cost you thousands in an agency.
Yeah. Made me a fortune.
Brilliant. So what challenges, Angus, do you face now when integrating these green solutions into your urban environments, particularly when it comes to the likes of sustainability and maintenance?
Yeah, the challenges are client approval of what you're doing and assurance that they're going to last the course, and then you've got to be competitive as well, because there's other living wall companies out there. We haven't got a monopoly. We have on our pillars, but not on our living wall system. So the it's a commercial environment. So yeah, it's tough. This rule, as I mentioned earlier, rules and regs. So yeah, I think the biggest challenge is putting your plants in, making sure they're maintained correctly, and running the business that delivers that service, because running any business is hard work. I think the other challenge when you're bringing new products into the market, that's been a steep learning curve for me, because you don't just suddenly start with a new product. With the living pillars, there have been 5 years of research and development. There's been what we call intelligent failures, where you have to try things, figure they don't work, try something else. And that all comes out of your own cash. No one is providing you money. There are some tax credits from the revenue, admittedly, but that comes a couple of years later. You have to provide the cash to do this. And if you're not making money as a business, no matter how excited or passionate you are about your product, it's not going to go anywhere because you haven't got the money to put into it. So I think that, for me, it is the biggest challenge, because it is my passion to find clever ways to bring green in. But when you haven't got the cash to develop it, and when you're demanding cash, but you've got to pay your suppliers and your business comes first, it's incredibly frustrating. So I think that personally, that's my biggest challenge. I wish there was a wealthy benefactor out there saying, yeah, I love what you do. Here's hundreds of thousands of pounds. Go and save the planet. The utopia for me. If you know anyone, Jackie.
Well, you put it out there now. You never know, obviously, Angus. You never know. In the same way as, like, retrofitting in buildings, surely there should be on the way. I know it's not long. We're recording the middle of August 2024. It's not long since a new government has arrived, obviously, into the Parliament buildings in the UK. So early days. But will there not be some nice grants available and bits and pieces? Is there nothing on the horizon to fit your...
You've opened a can of worms, Jackie.
Have I? Oh, no.
Well, only so much that 5 years ago, I thought we didn't do any local authority work. I thought, well, let's make some inroads, figure out how it works. It's like wading through treacle, honestly. Or maybe I've been running a company, you get to make decisions, and generally they happen, and you can influence things. Local government, honestly, I don't know how anything gets done sometimes. That said, there's some very passionate people there, but who know the ropes and the rules. But the bureaucracy is incredibly slow. That said, I think there are what we found, and I'm not sure if this government is making a bigger difference than the old government, because local government seems to be another aspect of it all, whether you're what political persuasion you are in local government makes a difference to the end.
I can certainly jump in and say that, and in my tiny experience, because of course, you know, it's not a big, huge organization, Constructive Voices, I can certainly say the Cambridgeshire seems to have a lot of genuine action and things happening when it comes to this area, not specifically your area. I can't say that for sure, but they are doing some great work there. I can say
that's really good to hear. We've been more in London, but
sure.
Maybe I should get some emails out there. We have, on a big positive, there seems to be pockets of money that each individual council can access, so they have their own ways of accessing it. I can't. To bring, I think head government say, okay, we're going to make this amount of money available, and what it's going to be available for is to clean the air or bring biodiversity in or whatever. So councils have access to that. Wandsworth and Westminster have been very good to us, but I hear they're slightly wealthier boroughs. So there's obviously some sort of catch that some boroughs are in a better position than others, but I haven't figured out why. But there is money available. The challenge for us, Jackie, is a big one. The money's available for installation, but often it's not there for maintenance. And all what we do, plants need maintenance. You can't just put it up and go away. You can't put them up and say, right, that's it, job done. They need maintained. And we need technology often to maintain them.
Okay.
That's a big challenge.
So it's interesting, because when it comes to BNG, my understanding is, of course, with the 30 plus years, that has to be worked into. So why should it be any different for urban greening?
Good question.
Something.
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, I hope this government makes a difference. I hear stories that they're looking to cut back and it's been over-egged. But then, yeah, if you've got a country like Cambridge, you've got a lot of people there who want to do good. They seem to always make things happen. So maybe there's hope.
Hopefully there's hope, yeah.
We've got the solutions.
Certainly Cambridgeshire seem like an excellent example from what I know so far. So listen, going back to the likes of the emerging trends, in green infrastructure, what are you most excited about? Putting to one side financials for a moment.
Yeah. What do you mean? What am I excited about in...
Emerging trends within green infrastructure.
You mean the trend of bringing green into cities? I'm just generally excited that if there's a demand to bring green in, and we're at the forefront of this industry, we get to exercise what we've been doing for the last 10 years before it was topical. So yeah, for us, it's plants. And I suppose when you ask the question, it's about the greening industry, is about plants, because the whole sustainability thing wrapped up in it as well, and using less fossil fuel. But I think the most exciting thing is going to my vision of a city. You're halfway to completing my vision by bringing green into cities.
Well, that's a fuller question, which I think we should get to in a moment. Okay, and okay. We'll probably finish our chat on that one. But I had this random idea as you were speaking there, Angus. How would it be, or would it not be functional at all, to grow the likes of, we'll say, coriander and basil and different herbs out of like a lamppost? Is that...
Yeah, it'd be great. Well, you can.
Can you?
Berries, I think... Yeah, berries are good for your strawberries, your raspberries, your blackberries, your blackcurrants. They all grow out of our system and then grow around that. So you can come, if you can reach up, you can pluck them out and eat them. Vegetables, not so good. The brassicas, because they look a bit messy at different times of the year. So I wouldn't advise to grow, although they do grow well in our system. I would just caveat it by saying that the amount of pollution in our cities, probably not great to, I mentioned this earlier about roads, did cities design around roads? If you were to remove cars from the equation, that's the best way to remove pollution from cities. I would suggest plant lots of berries on your lamppost and then you can go around eating them.
That'd be fantastic, wouldn't it?
In fact, isn't it great? I was like picking, we call them brambles or blackberries, I think you call them, but yeah. They're doing well in the parts of South London at the moment. So bramble and apple pie is being made. But it reconnects you with nature, because before cities, before the Industrial Revolution, that's what we did. And haven't we just lost touch with, you can go out and pick fruit. We're just so used to seeing it in a package in a supermarket. You forget
Yes.
where it comes from. And then you probably get quite surprised seeing how it's commercially produced. But going into the countryside and picking fruit, or vegetables, it's just how it was. What's it called? The shifting baseline. You know, it's always moving. But go back 300 years, and you know, before the Industrial Revolution, we all had pockets of homesteads and self-sufficiency. That's gone.
It's not that long ago. I mean, I've said this to other guests as well, Angus. You know, it's not that long ago. If you think of it just through your own family, depending on the, you know, the length of how long people live within your family, we're talking just like, whatever, 4, 5, 6 generations,
yeah,
depending,
yeah,
no?
Yeah,
isn't
that.
It? So
yeah.
It's not that long. Now, finally, though, Angus,
yeah.
What is your vision for future cities?
Oh, that was coming. To cover our cities with green, just... To have, you know, when you see aerial shots or say, oh, high, like drone footage of a city, and see these amazing buildings, as I've got to my, I think, crikey, what have we done? There was a forest there. Look at all these monstrosities. So my vision is to cover them all with green. Because then you've not just gone F off nature into this bit and say, I've excluded you. There was a part there and a part there, but the rest is just massive glass and concrete building saying, look how great we are, cover them with green, and then we've got half a chance. So it's, I think verdant has to come into my vocabulary at that point. So a verdant covering or verdant blanket of green over all our cities, I think that would be my vision. Roads, you know, go, use the underground, just, you know, use a bike. I got on a forest bike the other day, and I thought, I haven't been on one. I thought, they're incredible. No pollution, you can, anyway. So, lots of, no cars, lots of bicycles, lots of walking. Certain roads turned into biodiversity corridors, which are nothing but green. So allow people to walk everywhere. Walking's better for you as well. So, but I think the overarching vision is a blanket of verdant green over all our cities. And let nature look at us. Nature can be up high in the buildings. And they look at us down on the ground, walking around, as opposed to us doing it the other way, looking at nature.
Fantastic. So what a wonderful way to end with your vision. Angus, has been really interesting talking to you.
This is Constructive Voices.